Welcome to the latest edition of the Testudo Times Outtakes podcast. I'm your host, Lila Bromberg, and today I'm joined by Marty McNair, the father of Maryland football offensive lineman Jordan McNair, who died after suffering a heat stroke during an off-season workout in 2018. Marty, thank you so much for joining me to discuss some really important issues, including the work of the Jordan McNair Foundation. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for having me, Lila.
So it's been almost 3 years now since Jordan's tragic death, and you and your wife Tanya have been doing so much since to prevent further heat-related injuries and prioritize the safety of student-athletes, and have just become so fully involved and invested in this cause. But before we get into everything, I have to ask, just how have you guys been doing? I know this has to be something that is still so tough.
We're doing okay. I mean, life will never be the same. You know, clearly, you know, there's losing Jordan, you know, literally took a piece of our hearts with us, with me and his mom, Tanya. But for the most part, you know, we the last 3 years have been, you know, extremely life-changing, to say the least, as it would if you any parent loses a child. But, you know, hopefully, you know, we've gotten to a level of some type of resolve here, you know, just in regards to legal battles and things like that. But the main goal right now, which has always been since he's passing, is really to carry his honor, or just, you know, continue to honor Jordan's legacy by doing the work of the foundation we've created.
Yeah, and we've definitely covered the foundation a lot on the site, but for people that might not be as familiar, just could you tell us a bit more about the process that went into founding that and kind of how it's evolved since then?
Yeah, so basically, one of the things that, you know, when Jordan was in his hospital, you know, fighting for his life for those 2 weeks, you know, we kept asking ourselves as parents, Tanya and I just kept asking, you know, what did we miss, you know, and all these different things when it came to the type of injury that it was a heat-related injury, and a heat stroke for the most part. And one of the main things is that, you know, we didn't know about these things. And one of the things that we just kept saying to ourselves was, if we don't know these things of having a lifelong student athlete from AAU, obviously up to the collegiate level, if we didn't know these things, how many other student athletes or parents of student athletes don't know these things? And one of the things, you know, one of the many things that I taught Jordan to just developing him and raising him as a young man and just teaching him some good qualities, you know, I told him everything except for what I didn't know. And, you know, I taught him how to always be a leader, never a follower. You know, we stand up for himself, especially amongst his peers, and, you know, just always kind of have some decent, a level of integrity, you know, morals and principles that, you know, I felt as though it was especially, you know, important to raise him on. However, a lot of things that I didn't tell Jordan, and that was really to, as a student athlete, if you feel uncomfortable ever, don't do it. And if, you know, your body tells you to stop, stop. So it was just basically, I told him everything that I thought I knew. It was just what I didn't know was really, you know, what kind of added to his, I think, could have been prevented in regards to, you know, his safety and well-being. And what we did was we started the foundation based off of those things, you know, really, if we didn't know these things, you know, how many other parents don't know these things? And Jordan was not the first player to die in the NCAA since the year 2000, but, you know, he fell in predictable statistics that we would lose 2 to 3 young men, you know, on the football field as a result of this type of injury every year. And it was like, wait a minute, we had never heard of the other young men that had died, you know, and I was totally unaware of what a heat stroke was, this type of injury. And I think our grief just was so heavy at that particular time, we had to put it into a positive direction so it wouldn't consume us negatively. And this is where, you know, the idea from the foundation to really promote awareness, education, and prevention around this type of injury began.
Right. And what was that process for you guys of just really finding out more about this information, really kind of diving into this research? Because, you know, you guys have really become experts on this topic over the past few years.
Yeah. So for me, mine started like soon as, you know, when we got the call saying that Jordan, you know, had a seizure and, you know, that day, that was a call that we got, you know, and, you know, initially it was just a matter of, you know, let's find out what happened first. And then, you know, still not really knowing the magnitude of what was going on. And all I knew that, you know, the first night he was in the hospital and then the second night, we went from Washington and Venice Hospital, and they airlifted him to University of Maryland Shock Trauma Unit. So I knew it was a lot more, it was a serious scenario at that time. And I literally just had to know, like, really, how did we go from a healthy kid Tuesday morning? And the last time I had spoken with George was May the 28th, I believe, which was that Monday. And it was just a normal, you know, college, father to son, college kid conversation. It was just basically like, hey, you know what? I know practice starts tomorrow. You know, hey, you know, have a good day. You know, have a good practice. Call me and let me know how it went. So it was basically like, you know how you guys get as college kids, you call home only really when you need something, but you may only call home once a week, you know? So I was really expecting a call later on in the week. So how did the question, another one of our questions was, how do we go from a healthy guy Tuesday morning that had never been in the hospital a day in his life, you know, was healthy as a horse, to an emergency liver transplant Friday afternoon? And it was like, wait a minute, what happened? Because, you know, that was very significant. And, you know, one of the things with that was, it was just like, you know, how did this happen? And I had to really teach myself, because like it was a lot of sleepless nights for me for maybe like those whole 2 weeks, because, you know, when I would leave the hospital, I would go home and just research everything that the doctors had told me and, you know, research, you know, keep in mind, we were totally optimistic that Jordan would make it. Like, him dying never was ever a thought for us. We knew he wouldn't play football again, but, you know, we knew he was tough enough, really. We were praying that he was tough enough to really make it through this. And life, I knew life would change after this, you know, from him not doing what he wanted, always loved to do, which was play football. But I just really, really dug into, it was a lot of sleepless nights, and I just kind of, you know, got online and I educated myself, you know, and just researched, you know, what the liver does, what heat stroke does, how are they preventable? What's the lifespan of a person with a liver transplant? I mean, I just kind of really, really dug in. And that's how we really kind of got educated on this, because, you know, it was so many things that, you know, we really didn't know. So I had to educate myself, basically, short of going to medical school, you know, for that time. But I felt like I did, especially in this scenario.
I guess kind of at what point did you guys realize that, you know, he wasn't going to make it? And, or is that just, you know, extremely sudden thing? And then how do you kind of dealing with that, and then kind of juggling all of this stuff of, you're still learning all this information, dealing with, you know, media and investigations, just that has to be so much to deal with at once.
Yeah, actually it was. You know, Tanya and I were optimistic. Jordan passed June the 13th of 2018. We were literally optimistic all the way up until the 11th. And, you know, he had some setbacks. And when you're at that level of a medical acuteness and things of that serious medically, you know, it's what they call the ICU shuffle. And it's like, you know, it's one good day, one bad day, one good day, one bad. It could be one shift, one good shift, one bad shift. Unfortunately, you can't have two bad days, or you can't have two bad shifts, because that's just how sick he was. And at that time, I think on the 11th, he had two bad shifts. And it was just like, you know what, you know, he wasn't getting any better. Some other complications that came up. And it was just a sense of calm that came across Tanya and I on the 12th, because all our days were spent at the hospital. And when we left after visiting hours, it was just a sense of calm that, you know, we never wanted to compromise Jordan's quality of life when the time came. And, you know, the 13th really was the day where, you know, the doctors called and they said they didn't expect him to make it through the day. But, you know, we had kind of made peace with that the day before, because, you know, it just really was like, you know, much as we loved our son and we would love to have him here, we wouldn't want his quality of life compromised to that degree.
What was that kind of experience like after that? I mean, you're dealing with such a terrible loss, and then, you know, you're dealing with kind of all the attention that comes with it, both with, you know, doing all that research and really becoming advocates for this, but also just kind of investigations that were happening and all the different attention. Just what was that experience like for you guys as parents?
Yeah, I mean, interesting to say the least. Luckily, we had a very good legal team. You know, I say the best legal team, because, you know, it was a lot of stuff that, you know, I think for us, you know, we kind of wanted to get all the facts first before we start talking to the media and things like that. And the media was very, very persistent at that time, as soon as Jordan went down. But again, I just think that, you know, we utilize the media, you know, the right way, to the point where it worked for us as opposed to against us. And like, again, you know, we wanted facts, and that was really one of the good things for us, that, you know, we're not saying anything until we know what happened. And it's just unfortunate that so many people speak without knowing what happened, and they speak to the media. And I just think with us, you know, our strategy was, you know, let's find out everything that happened, and then we'll, you know, make a statement worthy of making, you know, to kind of go from here. But it was very challenging to just lose your child. And I mean, the media attention that was surrounding it, and the media attention that was constantly hounding us, you know, asking us what happened. And, you know, I think that the one of the challenging parts was not saying anything, you know. But again, that was really the strategy at that time. Let's find out what happened first. And then the grief was really beyond, you know, we had to do something to keep us sane, for lack of a better term. And the foundation really kind of did that.
How kind of gratifying has that experience been with the foundation of just learning more about this and really creating that purpose?
Extremely, you know, just from a perspective of, unfortunately, you know, we haven't lost any more young people. We lost one young man at the college level as a result of a heat-related injury that August, Braden Bradford. However, you know, when you look at the big picture, which a lot of people don't see, you know, Jordan's life and the work that we're doing and the attention to our story may have saved 6 or 7 young men already since he's passed, because realistically, it was 2 to 3 predictable statistics of young men that would have died since then, you know, since Jordan's passing. And you look at 2 to 3 guys at the college level were going to go down every year, same way he did, based off of the same things, always on the first day of practice. And usually, you know, some may succumb to the heat-related injuries, you know, but again, it was always pretty much the same. However, we still lost maybe 20 young people last year at the AAU and high school level. So, our goal was really to let's educate as many people as we can, parents, coaches, student athletes, in regards to this type of injury. And, you know, clearly, unfortunately, we're still losing young people across the nation. Last year, in the midst of a pandemic, we lost 20 kids last year, you know, and these are places that you would never, ever hear of. And the work that we were doing is just say, you know what, our mission is to promote awareness, education, and prevention around heat-related injuries, and to diminish the deaths from this type of injury. And, you know, we can't stop it, but we can diminish it by, you know, literally educating as many people as we can. And we do that by educating people. We donated over 300 cold water tubs pre-COVID to sports programs. We didn't care what it was, you know, what type of sport, where it was, what level of competition. We basically donated those tubs from literally Alaska to Florida.
I know you guys, you know, did that. You guys had done workshops, and then you kind of get into process of with what we're kind of discussing today, of kind of getting more into the legal side of things and wanting to have you know, some legislation pass and things like that. When did you guys first start thinking about that as something that you want to explore?
Yeah, we started looking at, because one of the main things, you know, it's always a great way to honor your child's legacy, especially in a scenario like this, where you get a level of legislation passed or a law passed. So our first bill that we got passed was in Baltimore City with Mayor Brandon Scott. So he was the city council president at that time. And basically that bill was the Jordan McNair Youth Safety Protection Act. And again, it's in a municipality in Baltimore City. And basically what that means is that particular bill, all AAU coaches that play in Baltimore City and they use the city of parks and recreations facilities have to be trained in a variety of things. So this is where education comes in, from heat-related injuries, CPR, cardiac arrest, how to use an AED machine, and also how to identify the signs of child abuse. So it's another partnership with the Department of Social Services. And then I started doing some work one day. I was reading the paper and I started doing some, saw another bill, the Jordan McNair Act. And that basically was a bill that was already established. However, we added Jordan's name to that, because that goes back to, or that bill is to protect college student athletes in the state of Maryland, if they feel uncomfortable on any student athletes, if they feel uncomfortable with any type of coaches or anything in that particular arena, they can call anonymously and make a report without any type of fear of any type of repercussions or anything like that. So in the process of doing some work with our delegate, Shelley Heddleman, which she's now Senator Heddleman, she had introduced me to Delegate Brooke Learman. And this was probably back in, I want to say maybe towards the end of the year in 2019. And we started talking about what is now hopefully the Jordan McNair Safe and Fair Play Act. And basically it was talking about, you know, we just started the discussions about players getting paid for their likeness. But really what caught our attention was the health and wellness and safety component of the bill. And basically what that meant was, you know, this is return to play. This is student athlete safety. This is student athlete self-worth. And basically, you know, it really didn't, the merit that it had, I really didn't fully understand the whole legislation process at that point, because I really wasn't aware of, you know, House bills, then it has to go to the Senate. You know, so again, I really wasn't aware of the full process. And I tell people all of the time, my understanding of how a bill was passed, I'm probably old enough to be your father. They used to have this really cool commercial that came on TV every Saturday morning. And it really was like an info commercial. And it was just, you know, this little bill, and they would show him sitting on Capitol Hill. And basically that was really my only understanding of how a bill got passed. And
you're talking about Schoolhouse Rock, right?
Schoolhouse Rock. Yeah. Okay, cool. So you're familiar with it, right? Schoolhouse Rock. And, you know, basically that was really my comprehension of how a bill got passed. Like I had to go back and look at the something that I could relate to, but the definitive, how definitive it was, and at the basic level, how to get a bill passed. I didn't understand the House. I didn't understand what the Senate was or whatever. So now that we're in it, I initially didn't have a full understanding of it. I just knew that Jordan was old. Jordan had become the poster boy for collegiate student athlete safety. And I knew that's what attracted us to the safety component of it. Not necessarily, I didn't really fully understand the players getting paid for their likeness. And I don't think a lot of people still do either. I have a better understanding of it now. But those were really the things. I just know as a parent, of any parent, and I think I speak for all parents in America that send their kids off to college, we expect them to return, you know, better than they were when they left, you know, at least more educated and ready to, you know, be successful in the world. Nobody sends their student athlete or their student away to college to not return. You know, nobody sends their student athlete or their child away, you know, regardless. Nobody sends their child away for them not to return, much less die in the process. So those were things that were very significant to me. This year, you know, it didn't pass the House last year. However, you know, we retweaked some things. And when we got it this year, our main focus was really the health and wellness component of it, because, you know, player safety is the Jordan McNair Foundation's motivation. You know, those are the things that we focus on here. So this year it looked a lot better. We had a different understanding of it. And it's ironic because the things that matter to us most, not the players getting paid for their likeness, however, the player safety and wellness, returning to play, their scholarships are protected, those type of things, that's what took the forefront. So it really worked out, you know, almost serendipitously in regards to that this year.
You guys have put so much work, as we've talked about, into this foundation, into creating these initiatives. How much has it meant over the past year to really see some of the stuff start to come to fruition from a legal side of things, and especially with having this bill passed, going through that third reading in the House of Delegates and the State Senate? Just how much has that meant to you?
Oh man, I mean, this is one of our most major, this is one of our most significant victories in regards to the work that we do. You know, one of the things, Lila, is, you know, people understand, you know, that these last 3 years have been very tumultuous, to say the least. Mm-hmm. You know, the media attention and, you know, the legal battle that we had, you know, that we finally resolved. But again, you know, it was really like a scab that just wouldn't heal. You know, like really, you know, every time you see a child, you know, in the media, you know, it's just like a stomach, a punch in the gut. And, you know, really it was just like, you know, you really want some closure for this. And one of the things that, you know, we realized was like, guess what? This only prepared us to fight in a bigger system or a bigger platform in a sense. So, or bigger arena. So I think that, you know, this was, everything just kind of worked out timely in regards to, you know, the battle that we had. It took almost 3 years for us to resolve this scenario. I mean, this was a significant thing. It really was never about, you know, a settlement amount, because, you know, no amount can bring, you know, Jordan back, which is most important to us. However, it does give us an opportunity to continue to do the work that we're doing, that we're committed to doing. Now, I think that even in the political arena, what that does also is, you know, sometimes, you know, everything can't come along too easy, you know, and I just think that, you know, you really don't understand the magnitude of the victory if it just went through, say it just went through the first time, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like, now, you know what, I think that, you know, us seeing that what it takes to go there, and I applaud the state of Maryland just because, you know, we've had the fortitude and the persistence, you know, Delegate Brooke Lehrman, Senator Reedy, you know, I think that, you know, I applaud both of them for, you know, hey, even get behind this and including us in it. I'm just glad that one of the things for us, we had created something tangible to connect to all of these things, and we just weren't lip service. And we, you know, luckily I'm grateful that we had application to what it is that we said we were going to do and what we were doing in a sense to make a difference. In regards to student athlete safety. So to us, this was significant. And I just think that, you know, what it does is it just created a platform for other states. And I just hope other states really see the magnitude of you protect your own players. You know, the NCAA, you know, they, and this is the thing, let me say this. The NCAA has a $10,000 life insurance policy on every student athlete that I hope no parent should ever have to experience that, right? And the point that I'm making, it is an organization that we always try to make it look like it's an Oz type entity. And I don't know what they do, you know, but again, you know, it's like, if you don't know the value or the level of empowerment that you have in a sense, you know, I guess you'll never know what you can do. But one of the things that I learned throughout the legislation process last year was the NCAA doesn't trump state law. They can't tell a state what to do. So if a state says, hey, this is the laws that we want to put in place, and this is the laws that we, you know, strongly believe in to protect ours, our student athletes, and this and that, and this is, we want to pay them, you know, or they can get paid for their likeness and image. I say, you know, I applaud them because, you know, really, we can get so caught up in, you know, hey, the NCAA does this, or they say that. And I just think that, you know, nobody has to wait, and no student athlete in America is property of the NCAA. So I just think that this was ideal on a much, much bigger platform to not only keep our student athletes safe in the state of Maryland or any state that's adopted this or who will adopt it in the future, but also to give them a level of empowerment to say, hey, you know what, I'm worth more than I can actually get my full worth in regards to, you know, like I said, it's all about developing our young people at whatever case that may be regarding their way to a higher level collegiate institution.
Right. And so obviously that main focus is on kind of implementing those guidelines for, you know, assessing and treating sports related conditions and injury and kind of that response. But you mentioned kind of now kind of working in the name, image and likeness stuff as well. And you mentioned it, it's something that a lot of people don't kind of understand. So I guess just to kind of give an overview for anyone listening, it isn't the schools paying the athletes themselves. It is simply allowing student athletes to make money off of their name. I'm a senior at Maryland. I can go out and, you know, market myself and make money off of those things. If I wanted to start like a clothing shop online or wanted to do anything like that, I can do that. Yeah. If I wanted to be paid for, you know, doing a certain internship or start a foundation, I can do that. Mm-hmm. As a student athlete, you can't do that for people who don't know. You don't have the right to use your name to make any amount of money. And this is something that not just applies to students who are kind of stars in that spotlight, but a lot of kids who are not going to make it to that next level and kind of are looking for a way to kind of support themselves while they are in college.
Totally agree. And you know, really to kind of piggyback off what you're saying, you know, keep in mind the percentages of young people, student athletes that literally go to the next level, just look at it. You know, you may have, mm-hmm. it's only 2-3%. That's it. So it's not like these kids are going to be used in video games or anything like that. But let's say, what about that other 98% or that other 97%? So if that young, you may have a student athlete that may, you know, maybe an artist, you know, or a student athlete that may play in a band, or a student athlete that, you know, they may be a likable person. He or she may be likable, and they want them to do a commentation of a AU event over the weekend or something like that, non-season or something to that effect. This is where they can get paid for their image or likeness. And this is what this kind of breaks down to. So again, like you said, colleges aren't paying you to come here and we're going to pay you to play. We're not doing that. Again, you know, hey, we give you an education. There's a reciprocal process. And one of the things that I emphasize to all student athletes, especially if you're on scholarship, anything, get everything you can get from that particular university or that higher level collegiate institution that they're getting from you. Because that's what I just said, even in regards to the NCAA, the NCAA makes hundreds of million dollars a year for you playing at a school or your team playing, or you're playing on a part of a team at a school. And guess what? In the event that something happens to you or that particular student athlete, you're only worth $10,000 to them. That's something to think about. And I think that this bill also creates self-worth of student athletes to the point where you don't have to feel vindicated or bad about saying, hey, you know what? I want to go out on the weekends and I want to play in a band and scenarios that we gave. And I don't feel as though I should be, I should suffer any type of infractions from the NCAA as a result of doing so.
Yeah. What's your reaction when you learn about kind of that $10,000 number and just kind of learning more of the intricacies behind the NCAA and just kind of how this all works and kind of the injustice of it?
Man, I think that, you know, unfortunately when it really makes you really see, you know, like, you know, hey, what? And again, I just think that, I'm sorry, I kind of get emotional when you ask that question. So let me back up. It's frustrating. It's frustrating, extremely frustrating. But if you don't know, and I just think that people give the NCAA way more credit than they actually deserve, to me. Mm-hmm. Again, here's an opportunity for the relevancy for student athletes, parents of student athletes, to see the value that the NCAA could do better in the event of, and hopefully no parent should ever have to experience this. But let's just say, for instance, you know, I mean, $10,000, that's not a lot. I think if anything, the NCAA should at least, the NCAA should at least increase the insurance policies of student athletes, at least to $25,000 per student. It ain't gonna cost them, it won't cost them that much, but that's just my personal opinion.
What has it been like for you watching over this past year? You were working on the book, which we'll discuss, and, you know, we mentioned working on this bill, but just watching everything from, you know, college football players playing kind of during COVID and getting COVID and things like that, and then watching also all the name, image, and likeness stuff continue and unfold. Just what has that experience been like for you watching from afar, just given your experience within all of this and everything you've learned?
Well, let me tell you, I told you, you know, the foundation, our number one priority is student safety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, you know, much as I like watching college sports and especially college football, you know, as if Jordan was still playing, you know, I still feel a certain type of way about, you know, I don't think that they should have had a season in regards to the pandemic. And every time I saw, you know, I talked to quite a few players on Maryland on the 2020 team that, you know, had got it. And it was just like, I still have that fatherly concern to say, hey, you know, how you doing? How you making out? Because I just think that, you know, it's a much bigger picture here. So to me, I'd rather see a player safe any day than to compromise themselves or the school to be in a situation like that. And never for my entertainment, but I understand it's a much bigger a scenario than me, or bigger platform than us. But, you know, I'm player safety first. If it was up to me, I would have said, hey, no, don't have a season until we get this underway. But that's just me. And like I said, that's just what, you know, our beliefs and our mission are, you know, from a foundation perspective. You know, I always want a child to be safe or student athlete to be safe, before, you know, my entertainment or enjoyment from watching the game comes into play.
Right. And I think you really saw that kind of intertwining over the past year of, okay, we're putting, you know, our lives on the line. We're literally kind of getting this disease. We can't see our families. We're going through all of this. And at the same time, you know, we can't even kind of make money off of our own name, and basically kind of you're kind of owning that right. What have you thought of kind of how student athletes have kind of really taken that onus and really gotten behind kind of this movement to push themselves for name, image, and likeness?
Yeah, well, I think that last year was such an interesting year, especially during the Black Lives Matter movement, George Floyd and everything. So what I really think that, you know, it really enlightened a lot of student athletes, and especially, you know, a lot of at a lot of colleges where student athletes were being mistreated. And I think that the awareness woke people up to say, wait a minute, coach was kind of saying some things that, you know, really didn't sit well with me, or he was kind of saying some things, you know, at a different type of maybe negative undertones and things like that. So I think what it did was it really woke all student athletes up in a sense. And it's just unfortunate that a lot of opportunities may have been missed in regards to, you know, a lot of players from, I was speaking to a friend of mine yesterday, and she was telling me her son was going to, he was still going to a great school. However, you know, he went academically because he felt as though he had missed his opportunity sports-wise just due to that particular year. So, you know, it just was really somewhat challenging in regards to not only student athletes, but, you know, imagine you go through 12 years of school to get to, you know, who wants to graduate? And a lot of people that really couldn't graduate or anything like that just due to COVID restrictions and things like that. So I just think that it put a new sense of normalcy on a lot of, on everybody for the most part. But, you know, you just still felt bad for young people because maybe their level to adapt to certain things or their ability to adapt the way maybe an adult would be, could do, was just a tad bit challenging. So I felt for everybody regarding that.
Right. And kind of during, I guess, towards the start of the, you know, pandemic last summer is when you have the book published. When did you kind of decide that, okay, you know, I want to write a book. This is something that I want to do.
Yeah. So I came up with, I started writing Can My Child Play? And I knew, you know, I wanted to share our story with the world. In regards to Jordan and everything that we have been dealing with over the last two years at that particular time. And I started writing in October, maybe September, October of 2020. And I would just kind of dabble here and there. And, you know, I might get on in the zone, maybe, you know, 2-3 weeks, maybe a month, right? And then, you know, I'm still moving around. And I was just telling my staff this morning that, you know, when pre-COVID, you know, I kind of had my whole year kind of planned out in regards to schools I was speaking at, states I was speaking at, you know, carrying the message of what it is that we do. And when COVID kicked in, I was like, you know what, I'll never have an opportunity to sit still for such a long period of time while we were in quarantine. And I just decided to make the best out of it. And it was like, you know what, I'm going to finish this book. And literally, like, you know, I finished it then. Luckily, I had a really good editor. And, you know, really, it was just like, you know, I was just kind of like very, very focused. So the release date of the book was, because Jordan passed on June the 13th. Mm-hmm. And what we usually do a health and wellness sports clinic where we focus on kids, but our main focus was on education of coaches and parents during that time. And that's always on June the 13th. So I knew we weren't going to do the camp just because of the pandemic. However, the release date, I wanted that to be a significant time to, you know, release the book, because that particular day just always means something to me. And what we try to do is just try to create some serious value around the day that Jordan died. And I released it that day, like a soft copy of it. I think we did the digital version of it, and still trying to tweak it. And the hardback came out on July the 5th, officially. Now, one of the things that, you know, the name of the book is Can My Child Play? And the reason the name behind the book is, or the title of the book is, Jordan was a lifelong athlete. And I, like every other parent in America, I only ask two questions. Can he play, and why isn't he playing? And that's, I think, as parents, those are the only questions that we have, where in reality, we should have a long list of questions. I told you earlier, you know, really, our list of questions didn't even start until we got the phone call saying that Jordan was injured. I came in the hospital asking questions, where in reality, if I had asked the right questions, you know, at that prior to while during the recruitment process of all schools, maybe we could have made a better decision. But, you know, it just was, you know, I think that this is our way of informing people on what questions to ask. There should be a laundry list of safety questions you should, every parent in America should ask prior to making a decision to let their child play at any AAU program, high school program, and definitely a collegiate program. And I just think it really, you know, the book really talks about my redemption, just in regards to raising Jordan, how I wanted him to be, you know, a better parent. It focuses on Jordan's mom, Tanya, and I just being wonderful co-parents and a successful formula to co-parent, and how we got Jordan to the level of success that we did together. So the book is definitely a really, really good read. It covers a lot of things. And I just think that, you know, it'll be enjoyed by all who decide to read it. You can purchase it at, you can go on Amazon, or you can get an autographed copy if you go to the JordanMcNairFoundation.org and order one from us. And I'll personally autograph and send it out.
And if you could kind of just summarize or kind of just give a little bit of insight, like what were those kind of most important questions that you learned about?
Yeah, so the most important questions, and even while Jordan, when Jordan was being recruited at Maryland, when the coaches came to a few days before signing day, I asked, you know, two questions. Can Jordan get some playing time? That was my first question. And secondly, I asked, you know, I'm in the substance abuse and mental health arena, and I asked what was the support around mental health and substance abuse for all of us players. Those were only two questions I asked. The questions that we should have asked was, do you have an emergency action plan? In the event that my child gets hurt or injured, what are you all going to do? What's the closest hospital? Who's going to ride an ambulance? Who's going to call me? Do you all have any safety trainings? Do you all have an AED machine? Do you all use a cold water tub? These are the questions that I should have asked to help us make an informed decision. If my child gets hurt, can he still go to the school if his scholarship is still good? So these are things that we should have asked, as opposed to me just asking those two questions. Can he play? Can he play? And which, you know, what my other question was. So it's a ton of other questions I think that will help any parent make a proactive, legitimate, informed decision to say, this is why I'm letting my son come to, or my daughter come to this school to play sports.
And I guess just one point I also wanted to hit on and ask you about, just what has it been like for you since, you know, Mike Locksley took over the Maryland program? And I know this has been something that's been really important to him, and that he's been a, you know, huge supporter of, and just to kind of like see the response. I remember, I think it was one of the stories I did when he initially came out, I had done it for USA Today or something else. I think one of the things that really stood out, the players, one of the first things was they had a Jordan McNair fundraiser at Chipotle. And I think he stood at the front and bought like $790 worth of, you know, food for people and things like that. Just what has that relationship been like, and to kind of see that support coming from the program?
Lox and I, actually I did an interview in his office yesterday. He let me use his office with a magazine yesterday. And this is the thing, you know, Coach Lox and I are like brothers. And this is what most people don't realize. You know, we don't have a football relationship. We both say that we're members of a fraternity that no parents wants to be a part of. And the way I say that is because, you know, unfortunately, you know, he lost his son, Miko. He and Kia lost his son, Miko, in 2017. So really it was Lox that would send me daily messages, and he would call me. And because at that time, from a father's perspective, who knew how to the experience of dealing with such a tragedy at this time? And Lox just walked me through every morning. That solidified our relationship at that particular time, during the time when Jordan passed, during the funeral. I mean, it was just extremely challenging. But, you know, he was kind of like a ray of light, you know, in regards to, hey, bro, I know what you're going through. You know, expect this. You know, even at the funeral, you know, he gave me some pointers like, you know, I know you want to be tough for your family and you want to be strong, but, you know, really just kind of brace yourself, because, you know, when they close the casket, that's a level of finality. But, you know, really the interesting thing is Lox and Jordan and and Locke's daughter, they had went to McDonough together. So they we were all at signing day. I think Locke's was in Alabama, but Locke's wife, Kia, and I were there while the kids were, you know, signing, you know, the seniors were signing that day. So, and then we always laugh because I remember we were standing outside of Jordan's 16th birthday party, and his daughter was there as well. So, you know, really he was out there as the dad picking her up. So we've always had a good kind of like indirect relationship, but I think that the loss of Miko and the loss of Jordan really just kind of brought us closer together. We started spending a lot more time together. I really think that even when Locks came back, you know, one of the main things it really at that time was, you know, and I applaud Locks for taking that position to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to come back. And at that particular year, it wasn't about wins and losses. It was just really a matter of how can I bring, you know, this community back together, you know, and make it whole again. You know, and I think that you really had to have a level of patience really to do that, because it wasn't about wins and losses that year. It was just really like, you know, how can we come in and how can we get complete in the midst of a tragedy? Because I just think if it wasn't for Locks, you know, the program could have went, you know, really in a total opposite direction. So I really think that, you know, he was the thought leader and the olive branch that really kind of brought, you know, the team back together. And you know, really, I mean, hey, I support him 100%. You know, he told me, I remember when I asked him to take the job. And then, you know, he was like, he was kind of on the fence. And then when he called me, you know, he said, man, you know, I haven't even told my wife, but I'm calling you first. I'm not going to do it unless I have you and Tanya's support. And clearly, you know, I knew it was from a place of genuineness. And, you know, hey, he had our support. He has my support, you know, 1,000%. Yep.
Right. And so with this bill passing in Maryland and, you know, the work you guys have done before in the state, and then having, you know, Locksley as that advocate who understands as well, just what do you kind of see for the potential of kind of maybe the example or standard that Maryland kind of can set with this partnership and with your organization leading the way?
Yeah. So one of the main things, I mean, in regards to the partnership with UND, we're in the process now of we created a medical advisory board. And basically what I'd like to see, you know, hopefully Maryland will, you know, buy into or help me create. I'd like to create a Jordan McNair Institute. You have a Corey Stringer Institute at UConn. And I think that, you know, really we can kind of do the same at University of Maryland. I think that really and what we've created, I'm just glad that we created something tangible to partner with in regards to the foundation. With, you know, whether we partnered or not, you know, our work still continued. However, I just think that, you know, really the credibility factor of, you know, having a UMD, being with the UMD, partner with a UMD organization or umbrella such as that, you know, we can really go a lot further. In regards to legislation, hopefully, I would like to see a domino effect of states following Maryland's lead. However, you know, really, one of the main things, Lila, is, you know, one of the things I learned is that, you know, the only way to make an impact in the nation is to create legislation and policy. But one of the main things, I like to see it done at a federal level, as opposed to we got to wait for a domino effect to say, okay, this state adopts it. If we can get to a federal level of legislation, I think that that would be impactful with colleges or all states have to follow these guidelines to protect our student athletes. And that's really the big picture. And I think that the Jordan McNair Foundation, you know, really we're up for the fight to, you know, get these things done in these states.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, and, you know, it's great to discuss such an important issue. Is there anything we didn't hit on that you wanted to add or things that people should check out?
Yeah, I think we covered everything. However, I encourage everybody to, we always have some, to check out our website, JordanMcNairFoundation.org. Please always follow us on Twitter. It's JM_Foundation. Please, our Facebook is Jordan McNair Foundation. Our Instagram is Jordan J Mac Foundation, I believe. And we always have what we're up to. What I do encourage everybody to, we always do fundraisers, and we had to get really, really creative during COVID, you know, to keep raising monies, to continue our mission or continue our efforts. And, you know, we do Peloton fundraiser rides. We did one in November. We did one for Jordan's birthday. But one of the things, we do a golf tournament every year. We do, you know, sports clinics every year. But like, we're really excited about doing our cute dog photo contest. And that's like everybody, my dog's running around here somewhere, so I would have held him up. But no board members can participate. But the main thing is we're launching that. That starts May 1st, I believe. And basically, to register your furry family member or your furry child, all you got to do is go to our Jordan McNair Foundation.org website. And the way that you win is all the votes are a dollar a vote per individual vote. So what you do is whoever gets the most votes, their dog wins the contest. So this is an ideal time to show all those cute doggy photos of, you know, hey, I've been sending them out to a couple of friends of mine. And everybody said, oh, my dog will win, my dog will win. So we will see. So please go to the Jordan McNair Foundation.org website and basically register your furry family member. And let's see, you know, who wins at the end of May. And so we're really excited about that. And basically everything else, you can kind of follow us in the work that we're doing along the way.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Hey, thank you so much, Lila.